Growing up in Wimbledon, surrounded by tennis championships and Edwardian houses, there was one problem. My brown skin and African name marked me as perpetually foreign. While my white classmates blended seamlessly into the landscape of plane trees and privilege, I faced the question constantly, "Where are you from?" Not the casual, "What's your background?" asked among friends swapping heritage stories, but an upfront demand for explanation, a daily ritual that reminded me I required justification for existing in my own country. This wasn't unique to my leafy suburb. My boyfriend Sam grew up in diverse Tottenham among Caribbean and African immigrants, yet he too confronted Britain's inability to see him as fully British. The difference? His neighborhood created influential Black British subculture, while mine pretended difference didn't exist. At 14, a well-meaning friend tried to comfort me. "Don't worry, we don't see you as Black." She thought she was being kind, but the message was clear. Blackness was something shameful, something to overlook rather than celebrate. So I tried erasing myself, briefly changing my name to Caroline, hoping to shed my alienness like an uncomfortable coat. Britain's collective amnesia about empire creates a peculiar haunting. Walk through Liverpool or London, and you'll find banks decorated with images of enslaved Black children in cuffs, architectural ghosts nobody points out because we've trained ourselves not to look. Hundreds of films cover World War II's 5 years, yet fewer than 20 address slavery's 400-year history. When Britain abolished the slave trade in 1807, it didn't free anyone. It merely stopped importing new slaves. The government paid $20 million to compensate slave owners, not the enslaved, while the remaining $27 million came from the slaves themselves through 4 more years of unpaid labor. Popular history actively erases this reality. Our Island Story, favored by former Prime Minister David Cameron, mentions slavery only when discussing its abolition, presenting it as benevolent white people saving poor Black people. This selective memory allows Britain to celebrate ending slavery while forgetting it built the trade. The deprivation characterizing enslaved people's lives, illiteracy, trauma, disconnection from African homelands, continues intergenerationally today. Yet we treat these outcomes as coincidental rather than structural. In 2016, I visited a swingers club hosting the Black Man's Fan Club, an event marketed to white women seeking sex with Black men. The promotional materials featured exaggerated racial stereotypes, images of exceptionally large Black penises, and scenes of racial dominance. My friend Sarah, a Black woman in the high-end swinging scene, describes how white participants perceive Black women as naturally very sensual and raw, expectations rooted in centuries-old stereotypes. Meanwhile, I recall my teenage diary. "I have had enough of my figure. It is so disgusting. I must have the biggest arse in existence." I felt my appearance was the opposite of every single image of beauty I encountered. My brown skin, my curves, my hair that was too frizzy to be European, yet too flyaway to be Afro. Google searches for most beautiful women return almost exclusively white women. Hairdressers routinely refuse to serve me, claiming they didn't know how to work with my hair. Yet when white celebrities wear cornrows and braids, it's celebrated as fashion, the same styles that get Black people penalized in schools and workplaces. The Williams sisters revolutionized tennis, but their brilliance was met with racist commentary describing their play as brute force and calling Venus an animal. Nearly 1 in 16 British children under 5 are mixed race, 1 in 8 in London, representing Britain's future. Yet many mixed race people with Black heritage feel conflicted about interracial relationships despite their own backgrounds. Ron, one interviewee, reveals his internal struggle. "I felt undesirable for being Black. I remember wishing I would go to bed at night not being Black." Science tells us race is meaningless. Humanity originated in Africa. Genetic differences between racial groups are negligible, and racial categories constantly shift. Groups once considered non-white, French, Southern Europeans, became white, while Muslim identities have been othered regardless of ethnicity. Yet this scientific reality doesn't erase lived experience. I met Lola, known as White Lola for her Cockney accent, despite being Nigerian-British. Raised by loving white foster parents who didn't know any black people, she thought Nigerian food was Nando's. She experienced racism. Their car was bricked, children attacked her, and developed severe eczema because nobody knew how to care for her skin or hair. At 7, social services moved her without warning to a black African family in Tottenham under race-matching policies. While her eczema cleared with proper care, the new foster father was abusive and alcoholic. Back with her original foster parents, Lola felt safe but culturally isolated. She remains caught between worlds. Black people wouldn't accept me as black. I do speak different, but when I'm around all white people, I gravitate towards black people. Britain's celebration of interracial relationships as proof that race has gone away misunderstands that mixed heritage people aren't less interested in defining their identity, they're often more so. After Oxford, I moved to Dakar, Senegal, convinced the right place would heal my fractured identity. Working for George Soros's Open Society Foundation, I supported journalists in war zones and befriended young Senegalese professionals who'd rejected their parents' Europhile ambitions to build businesses at home. But belonging proved elusive. To locals, I was just another privileged Métisse, a soft-spoken British girl with pretensions of being African. Office staff mimicked my airy voice that lacked their wall-like authority. After being attacked at the Mali market, stallholders demanded money to accompany me while shopping. I wasn't one of them, but another foreigner they saw as a source of income. 10 years later, I returned to Ghana as the Guardian's West Africa correspondent. The magical red earth and candlelit stalls had vanished, replaced by concrete and traffic lights. Following my grandmother through a market with my baby in a front sling, while local women carried theirs on their backs, unable to speak beyond basic phrases, I felt like any American tourist, perhaps more awkward due to my shame at failing to fit in. Ghana remained part of my identity, but I discovered identity can't be created from insecurity. Gaps in my Britishness didn't mean equivalent belonging in Ghanaianness. After 11 years of private school and 3 at Oxford, I thought nothing about race, class, and privilege could shock me. Then I became a barrister. The legal world revealed itself as a cloistered realm, Lincoln's Inn with its Tudor walls, Great Lawn, and Hidden Park built during Henry VII's reign. This oasis lacked diversity in every way, even down to the dark suits everyone wore. My experiences included being warned about a QC with a thing for groping black women and dealing with inappropriate colleague behavior. The media world I later entered was characterized by persistent typecasting, certain topics seen as black and the rest as white. Despite Greg Dyke describing the BBC as hideously white in 2001, diversity in creative sectors actually declined from 7.4% to 5.4% between 2006 and 2012. British actors like Idris Elba typically gain recognition only after American success. As Elba told Parliament, "I could only play so many best friends or gang leaders. There wasn't enough imagination in the industry for me to be seen as a lead." Successful Black Britons consistently report being underestimated in education. Akala, despite being academically gifted, was discouraged from pursuing science and placed in special needs classes. As a defense lawyer, I witnessed this cycle with 15-year-old Lamar, who stabbed another boy after his mother repeatedly sought help from social services following his father's death. The system only intervened after he committed a crime, spending $100,000 per year to incarcerate him, 3 times the cost of Eton. During the trial, I discovered that Lamar, who had attended school daily for 8 years, could neither read nor write. When choosing my daughter's surname, my partner worried about discrimination with his African name, while I saw his Ghanaian surname as a precious gift, a connection to heritage and people who would recognize her as one of us. We gave her Ghanaian names, refusing to accept a prejudiced world. She sees herself as brown, without the baggage that makes blackness threatening, simply a color and heritage to be proud of. She draws herself with glittery brown skin and spiraling curls. her identity shifts contextually. Christian with Muslim friends, firmly a girl with boys, proudly Ghanaian with white British families. Britain's younger generation is reshaping this narrative. Grime artists celebrate African heritage through movements like Tina, This Is New Africa, while multicultural London English has evolved from local dialect to nationwide phenomenon. A 2017 poll revealed immigration ranked last among young people's policy concerns, with 70% supporting continued EU membership, a stark generational divide. Yet Britain's failure to embrace inclusive identity drives increasing numbers of British-born Ghanaians to relocate to Ghana, citing profound rejection despite being thoroughly British, a significant talent drain. Britain's colorblindness, I don't see race, fails because blindness isn't a strategy for seeing. The solution requires confronting Britain's convenient ignorance about its past and genuinely embracing meritocracy. I've evolved from feeling other to cherishing my Black identity, which enriches my relationship with Britain. My purpose lies here, where I understand the texture of wrongs and opportunities, not escaping somewhere else, but claiming my full place in the country that is already mine.